So today is the 18th of June 2019. Here we have Lauren Harris and Keris Terry, and we're interviewing Andrew Jenkins, the previous CEO of Cardiff YMCA Housing Association. Hi Andrew, how
Hello
are you
there.
Doing?
Good, fine, thanks. Hello.
Good. So we've just got a few questions for you really. So how did you start in the YMCA? Let's go right back from the beginning.
Well, I suppose the start was my father was in the YMCA before me. So when I was born, he was running the Abbotridwell YMCA. And so I was born into the YMCA. And my first experience in YMCA was something I can't remember, which is a YMCA camp when I was about 1 year old. So it goes back that far. And I've known the YMCA all my life as a result. We've lived in YMCAs as accommodation was tied with the job. And as we moved around as a teenager, I drifted apart from the YMCA. I didn't really have anything to do with it. Certainly didn't think I'd end up working for the YMCA. So for a few years, as most teenagers would do, rebel, I didn't have anything to do with it. But my early days, we lived in Porth YMCA, and we had associations with Taunton YMCA as my father moved around different places. When I left school, there were a number of opportunities open for me, and I got through a number of different interviews, but I thought I needed to go to college. And so at that time, I wasn't good enough for university. I hadn't really done anything in the sixth form, so A-levels were out of the window. And I ended up in a teacher training college, or colleges of education, as they were then called, in Swansea, where the only course available for my qualifications, such as they were, was youth and community studies. So I took it, but I didn't really think much more about it. For 3 years then, in the early 70s, I trained as a teacher and as a youth worker, and came out the other side wondering what I was going to do next, because I certainly didn't want to be a teacher. And jobs for youth workers were few and far between. My father intervened and sent me different bulletins of jobs that were in the YMCA at the time. So this is 1975. And there was one in Bournemouth. And I wrote to them and applied for the job and got it, much to my surprise. So it was that's where I started my career as a youth worker, Bournemouth YMCA. That's where it all sort of began. So there's a mixture, one of childhood memories of being in the YMCA where my dad worked, and then again my dad influencing me to apply for a job and getting it in Bournemouth. And the first day I had to make a decision when I went up to the front door, do I just turn around and go back to Wales or do I go in? And that's, I went in. It was a horrendous experience first year. I didn't think I would possibly get any further. And I did overhear somebody saying he won't last a week or he won't last a month or something like that. And that was, I think, again, these things when you look back, and I've always said that, it's not sort of, that's true. Someone did say that, and I thought, well, I'll stick it out a year. I'll do a year, and then I'll go home. And I was engaged at the time and everything, so it was sort of like quite a wrench. But I survived the year. In fact, 44 years, I think, in the end. So that's the start of it. That's how I became involved. And almost fighting against it, I ended up in the YMCA.
So, like, touching back to, like, childhood experiences, is there any memories you've got of, like, living with the YMCA or, like, growing up?
Of course, yeah, many, many of them. And I suppose Porth YMCA, which is at the base of the Rhondda, isn't there now. It burnt down some years ago. But we lived in the flat. It was a former pub come hotel. And it still had... in the coffee bar, the original bar and the sort of pub tables and chairs. And it's quite good as a kid to be living somewhere which has a sweet shop downstairs. And when the YMCA was closed, I had my friends around. We had the whole run of the place, which was huge, of course, to us as kids. And the memories I've got of the YMCA then in the Rhondda in the 60s, is that it was very much the hub of community. And although I suppose I didn't see it at the time, everything happened there. And I was thinking about it not long ago, and every Tuesday, I think it was, the table tennis room became the baby clinic for Porth and surrounding areas. So the whole building was full of screaming babies as their jabs, and mums picked up the milk powder and babies were weighed. In the room next to that, on another day, there was the Youth Employment Bureau, as it was then. So young people would come and be interviewed by the youth employment officer. I don't know what the equivalent would be now, maybe a job centre. So it was a part-time job centre. The local brass band would practice there. The flower show would be there. The canary and bird show just came back into my mind. So the gym, which was upstairs in Porth, would become a centre for various things. So it would be full of caged birds. Quite magical. Again, as a child, this was quite exceptional. Or it would be jumble sales. Jumble sales would be held quite often. That was one of the fundraising things. I don't have them now, really. The Christmas fair would be another. And I remember army recruitment being there as well. So army recruitment office would take over, and there'd be guns and all kinds of things laid out on tables. Do you want to stop? Carry. So these things were like the major events, and they were, they seemed normal to me. In the gym, there was and in the '60s, basketball was in the valleys a very strong sport, and I remember my dad playing basketball, and there would be a whole crowd of us up on the stage watching the basketball match, which would be a needle match, and it would be different YMCAs playing each other or different clubs. Other sports, well, I suppose, yeah, another memory comes back into mind. There were football teams, of course, and the football team's kit would need to be washed. So there may be two or three teams playing on a weekend, and the kit would be in our bath, in our flat, in the YMCA. It would be soaking. So there would be, the bath would be full of muddy tops and shorts and so on. And there were so many other different groups. I joined some of them as a kid. There was the in the cellar of the YMCA there was the woodwork shop, so there were woodwork classes. There were art classes, and there was judo, which was very, very popular. I don't know how popular it is now, but certainly in the 60s and 70s it was a big sport, which took over from, in Porth's case, the billiards, because every YMCA had a snooker room, snooker table, billiard table, and gradually that sort of in the 60s phased out, unfortunately in some ways, because snooker came back into fashion in the late 70s, early 80s, by which time most of the snooker tables had gone. In Porth, it was a hive of activity, and that's how I remember it. And it was just always there was something going on. So it was the centre, it was the youth club, it was the old people's club. There were groups of every age group were able to get involved. Right throughout the last century, really, I think it sort of died out in probably the 80s, maybe the 90s. There was a thing called a Women's Auxiliary. And Women's Auxiliary, because obviously, what young men's Christian association tended to be all men and boys, but women were allowed in to make the tea, and bring cake in and make sandwiches. So Women's Auxiliary raised money and had their own trips and so on, did their own activities and program, and that was a key part of the YMCA's work and how it survived in those times. There were. In that YMCA, it was a pets club, a photography club, there was a chapel. So there was something for everyone at that time. And looking back, of course, it's through rose-coloured spectacles a bit. When I went on in the YMCA myself, much of that was still there in the mid-70s. So this YMCA, which had taken on youth work from the local authority, or it started the youth work, funded by the local authority, it was a new thing. And I think the YMCA certainly had tried to do this going back 50 years earlier, but it hadn't really taken off. So I think YMCA was a forerunner of youth work, probably in the world, but certainly in the country.
Yeah.
So do you want me to say more about it? I mean, I'm going to have to edit this bit, obviously, but...
No, that's great. I was just listening.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were at the YMCA for, was it 44 years?
Yeah, I think maybe 43 or something like that. Yeah.
So we're intrigued. What different roles have you actually had here, from obviously being a boy that's lived at the YM to becoming the CEO? Like, what roles did you have in between?
Well, it was a meteoric rise over 40 years to get to be CEO, of course.
Yeah.
I wasn't exactly fast-tracked. It started off in Bournemouth, I'd say, and I was the, I think it was youth worker, or was it youth leader? I think it was called youth leader at the time. So I was the youth leader at Bournemouth YMCA, and it was the first time they'd had a specially funded post of youth leader. So the general secretary, as chief execs were then called, was very proud of the fact that he now had a fully paid, qualified youth leader. He didn't know me well enough, of course, to realise I was completely new to the whole thing and I had no idea what I was doing. So my first experiences in Bournemouth YMCA were quite, as we say now, a steep learning curve, because I'd not even been in a hostel other than a student hostel before that. And I lived in the hostel in Bournemouth as part of the job, and that sort of thing happened quite a lot. And so you took in meals with the people you were working with in some ways. It was an all-male hostel, which came with certain issues, and it was quite traditional in other ways. I suddenly found I had to give the prayer meetings, and every one in three prayer meetings, work one in three weekends, work four nights or six nights a week, depending on what I wanted to do. If the night steward didn't come, then I was the night steward. So whatever it was. But I'd see my father do a lot of these things as well. Although he hadn't worked in a hostel, I knew that, you know, cleaning toilets and all the rest of it was fine. It was just part of the job. And I had struggled refereeing volleyball matches and things, and I wasn't pushed into doing basketball because I've got two left feet and two left hands, so I wouldn't have been no good at sport. I tried to do different things. But my main job there was to run the youth wing, which was at the back of the YMCA. And in Bournemouth at that time, although Bournemouth sounds like a sort of middle class, sort of ordinary town full of older people, it had a lot of problems at that time. In the 70s, there was even a curfew put on in the streets because of the fighting between Iranians and Iraqis, and things like nightclubs had to close early and so on. And there were two or three central youth clubs, because young people were hanging around the centre of Bournemouth, causing all kinds of problems, as young people are supposed to do all right throughout time. And ours was, Bournemouth YMCA still is, right in the centre of the town. And we had this place where people could drop in and had all the typical youth club stuff, the pool table, the dartboard. After a lot of arguing, I managed to get a pinball machine into, because the general secretary, Fred Daldry, didn't approve of pinball machines. And but once he saw there was an income, he suddenly changed his mind. But pinball machines, I don't know whether, do you still get pinball machines? I don't know. But this was one of the key parts of it. And we had board games and so on, and we did different activities. Skateboarding suddenly became a big, big thing in about 1977. And there are a couple of hills in Bournemouth by the pier where people would be in and out, and they were older people as well. So everyone had a skateboard, so we built some skateboard ramps in the gym, and we had skateboard club, and we did discos and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of activities. I'm trying to think now. Table football seemed to be a massive thing. We had three or four table football tables. Everyone was playing table football, and we had a lot of skill. And we had an all night. I don't know. I don't think it was 24 hours. It was certainly an all night table football marathon. And I only ever repeated this exercise once, because I never should have really. First, when you've done an all day and all night activity with the kids. And they get very grouchy and grumpy, and they've been up all night and you've fed them all kinds of rubbish. They're not very easy to handle the next day. I did go on and do an all-night roller skating marathon some years later, but that was it. You know, and never again will I ever do a sponsored thing. So the youth wing was quite small, but it was a good start, and I think I built up quite a good understanding of how to work with young people. I was only 21 myself, so when I stopped being a youth worker, I was still probably, by modern terms, a young person. And so I learned a lot. We set up different groups for different age groups. I think we had at one time a Saturday morning, what did we call it? So like almost like toddler club. We could get the trampoline out and put like, 3-year-olds on. Those days were strange because you could do all kinds of things. There wasn't any health and safety. And I'm a great believer in health and safety. But there were times where you could. I learned to drive in the YMCA minibus. And my boss, Fred, had said, right, you've got to learn to drive. This is no good. He didn't say I'd pay for the lessons or anything. So I could use the minibus to practice in. And he pointed out that the third gear didn't work, so he taught me how to double declutch and do various things. But I learned to drive in the minibus and passed my test in a car. And the first time I took the minibus out with people in it was with probably 13-year-olds. It was to Dorchester YMCA from Bournemouth YMCA. And this is the sort of thing that used to happen quite a lot. Youth clubs would visit each other and play pool and darts and table tennis and generally sort of intermingle, so people had a bit of a wider spectrum to their lives. So the kids all got in, and it was a 12-seater bus, so we had about probably 15 to 20 people in it, because that's what you did in those days. I don't think I can be arrested now for this. And they were misbehaving, and I remember turning around and saying, I only passed my driving test this week, so you better behave. In a very un-PC way, and they did, funnily enough. Well, on the way there, on the way back, it was a different story, but these are strange things that would happen. How on earth could you get away with these things? I took, in other places as well, people canoeing and camping, with no risk assessments or really or anything like that. So Bournemouth was my first attempt at it. I think I was a reasonable youth worker, but I think I could have been better looking back. I left there to go to Dartford YMCA, and which has become something else now. I think the building's changed, but also I think Dartford is now Thames Gateway YMCA, or part of it. And I was there the program director, which was, I went there for the title, really, I think. There was some more money, but, you know, it sounded good, program director. It was exactly the same job as I'd been doing, only slightly worse, because I was living in the house next door to the YMCA, so people thought I was the caretaker, which was okay, but the job there was not the same, because I liked working in the hostel. The hostel work in Bournemouth had been limited, but I did work with some of the people who lived there, and I had to be part of the management of the hostel as well. Dartford didn't have a hostel. It was always intended that it would have, but it didn't. It had two gyms. It was pretty traditional. I learned how to roller skate, and my main job sometimes was head of roller skates, and I could tell anybody's foot size, anyone's foot size, because I was always sort of saying, right, you know, I don't know if I could do it now, but seven maybe, but sort of it was a thing. So all the kids would come along. We had all these roller skates, learned how to repair roller skates, knew everything about roller skates, learned how to roller skate, and set up roller discos, because, and I suppose you remember the 1970s, but roller discos were the thing, you know, and dance was the thing. Saturday Night Fever had spurned huge competitions for young people, so the roughest and toughest of blokes would be doing organised dance routines to one group was it was to Walter Murphy's disco version of Beethoven's Ninth. I can't remember what it's actually called, but it's on Saturday Night Fever. And there were dance competitions, which in Dartford, and then all youth clubs in Dartford, and then beyond into Kent. We ended up having to go to a final somewhere in, I can't remember where now, somewhere in Kent. And it was a big, big thing. But roller discos were it. And, of course, 1978, I think it was, YMCA... The dreaded YMCA song came out, which meant that numbers at my discos were doubled overnight. It was the best advert we possibly could have. We had people queuing up the streets, so we had a roller disco in one gym and the disco in the other. And going back to health and safety, I did all the lights for the roller disco, and. It was a gym which had all the windows blacked out, so it was perfect for discos. I made the lights with wood and wires and bulbs and sockets, and then single-handedly went up ladders and attached them to the walls. And these are things which now would need a risk assessment, I guess. But it was quite spectacular. So roller discos, and there were trampolining clubs and the judo club, and we had to move things around all over the place. So we kept the judo mats on the third floor, and the judo room was on the second floor, which was, if I could go back and change things, you know, you would. And the trampolines were kept in the different room to where they were used. And badminton was the big thing there, as you know, sort of different YMCAs would have different things, and badminton ruled the roost in Dartford YMCA for quite a while, insisting that they could have the place open on a Sunday, so the caretaker next door, the program director, had to go in and open up. But it was interesting times. I don't think I really enjoyed my time in Dartford particularly, because I had a terrible boss who I hated, and it just didn't work for me. I didn't really feel like I fitted in. But I did enjoy working with the kids, and they obviously enjoyed working with me, because there was just this huge gang of kids, like, everywhere I went they would be. And I ran play schemes, and I sometimes wonder whether the children that were in those play schemes, so that would be getting on 40 years ago, so they'd all be in their 50s now, whether they remember the whole of their summer holidays being spent with me. So 6 weeks we ran play schemes from 8:30 to 4:30, I think, and fed them and all the rest of it. And I would take them swimming. Of course, that's perfectly okay. I was the only adult, but, you know, sort of 100 children to the swimming pool, to London Zoo, to the seaside. There were other leaders, but they were all my youth club. So the youth club leaders, we'd have intensive training. Not. We'd say, well, we're going to do a play scheme. Who's in? So everyone would turn up if they wanted. And some of them were very good at trampolining and roller skating and all the other things. And some parents came along as well, certainly on outings. I only lost children every so often. It wasn't many. London Zoo, I didn't realise how big London Zoo was, and took a coach load there. I also forgot the children are sick on coaches. So while I was cleaning up the sick on the coach, they were off into the zoo. We had them in groups. But a couple of people, children can be a bit naughty at times, and so can the leaders. So we did wonder how we, because we were due to go home, and there were still, I think, three or four people in London Zoo somewhere. And it is big, it's not Bristol Zoo, it is massive. So we did find them. Another time we went to, I think it was Broadstairs or Margate, and it's quite a train journey all the way down. And if you've run a play scheme, you know the main thing you do is count heads. You count heads and then you count heads again and then you count heads and you continually count heads. And we'd had a nice day at the seaside and no one had drowned or anything. We got back to the station and we'd lost two leaders. They had been in the sea and then so tough. So we're on, so everyone over to the other platform, onto the train. And but the sweet shop and it was on. Well, the shop was on one platform and we were on the other, and there were two particularly naughty boys, two brothers, and they wanted to go to the shop, and I didn't count heads at that point, so we were all on the train, counted heads, there were two missing. They were still in Margate or wherever it was we'd been, and we were all on the train. It was fortunate that the leaders that missed the train also were still at that station, so they caught the next train. But we had to stop the train at a station, telephone back, because there's no mobile phones or any other electronic device really then. So what am I saying, all these bad stuff, you know? But these were, I think, the freedom of the work at the time. You can see in some ways how that could have been abused and how in different places these things, abuse maybe did happen in different places over the years, and all the stuff that that's uncovered. But the attitudes in the 70s were quite different. And all these children spent an awful lot of time with me and this group of teenagers. And the relationships that were built in that time, I'd like to think, established something quite strong later on. We'd do all kinds of games. Oh, God. British Bulldog. British Bulldog was, so we'd start the day off with as many injuries as possible, and it worked, everyone loved it. And Pirates was another. We had a lot of equipment, so you'd have these games where you'd shout out to the rigging and everyone would have to run up to the wall bars, or the man the lifeboats was, you'd pair up with somebody and pretend to row, or there was all these things. So I'd be and it sort of that was how we started the days on these play schemes. But I think that was it was really tough, the trying to keep things going for the whole of Easter holidays and summer holidays. It was something which I'd cast to the back of my memory until this minute. And but yeah, I don't know. It was great. It was something very special. I thought the kids of that time thought so as well. I mean, relationships with, because I never really thought I liked teenagers particularly, or young people. And maybe that was a good thing, because I didn't really sort of, I work with them. I wanted them to behave like adults, maybe. I don't know. It worked. My relationship with young people worked really well. And certainly had allegiance from groups of people. Dartford was, I was glad to leave Dartford, really. I don't think me and the, I'm sure he didn't think much of me either, my boss there. We couldn't have got on any better than, you know, there was never going to get any better. So partly also due to ill health, I left Dartford, and the network in the YMCA then was such that. And I'd like to think that somewhere there's something like this today. It was very supportive. So I went to the regional officer when I was in Dartford to say to him, "I'm struggling. I don't think I can stay in Dartford." So joking aside, the person I worked with was doing my head in, and it really didn't work for him or me. And it was something which, whether I should say it or not, but I had a mental health issue because of it. And the YMCA, people recognised it then, but they didn't call it anything. So I went to Bill Leyland, his name was, went to see him, and he was amazing. I mean, this is a guy in 1980-ish, who would have been in his 60s. So came from another era, and he'd looked to see what jobs were around, and he didn't pull strings, but he had a word with the person around Balfe YMCA, and put my name forward to be interviewed, which I did. So Dartford was there for 4 or 5 years, I think. So then went to Bath YMCA as the youth secretary, and I was always a sucker for titles. So youth secretary was exactly the same job as program director or youth leader, really. And it was, I was in charge of the youth wing, and which was fantastic compared with the other places I worked. And it had a big sports hall, still has a big sports hall, a room next to it which could be used for all kinds of things. I used it for discos and roller discos in the sports hall, because that was I knew I'd been successful with that elsewhere, and it was a much bigger hall. And there was a proper coffee bar, and we had all the latest sort of arty furniture from the 70s. It was still there in the 80s, so it was quite a cool place to be. And but it was right in the centre of the town, and unlike Bournemouth, that was a detriment, really. People didn't come into the town in the same way, or they couldn't find us where we were. So I had to build up a youth club somehow. And there's nothing, no greater incentive than having a threat of your grant being cut. And this was the case at one point where... and youth work has changed because partly the funding has gone, and I could say a whole load about that. But at that point, we needed to do something, make sure the youth work worked. It was okay on numbers because we packed them in with roller discos and discos, and if there are boys there, girls will come, and if girls are there, boys will come. And so many relationships, maybe marriages, who knows, and children since of the people that met at the YMCA back in it was the late 70s, no, where was that, early 80s. So I don't think we did any dance things then. I think that was gone, but it was it certainly music has featured all the way through. We went on camps. Bath was big on taking groups of kids, as many as you could cram into a minibus, but not as many as they used to because the rules were changing. We used to go to Fairthorne Manor, and probably twice a year with different groups. Fairthorne Manor is a YMCA near Southampton in Botley, and it did all kinds of activities, still does, and is part of the Fairthorne Group now, which is Hampshire YMCA. And we would do pony trekking and abseiling and canoeing. But the main thing was we took a group of boys away out of the city, and they became children again in a way. Looking back, they would be, I suppose, 13 to 15. And we used to stay in Fairfield Manor in the Polish hut. Now, this is another strange thing that was acceptable in the 80s, but isn't now, is that this was a dormitory of bunks, and the boys slept in there, and so did we. So we, as the two male leaders, slept in there. The other male leader was the one who made sure that they all did go to bed. I was asleep. I know how I slept through all these young boys. It's mad. But my job was to get up in the morning, so I would be was the one that made sure that they got up, dressed, washed, had breakfast and all the rest of it. But they were routines. But it was great to see these young people able to be free enough to, and we gave them enough free time to be able to climb trees, play. And they were still playing, because some of them were probably only 12 or 13. And there was no external influences. They were just school children again, just for that short time. The activities were incidental, really, I suppose. no one particularly wanted to go in a canoe, especially was I would show them how to do it, but I was never very good. Those two left feet, two left hands came back in. The canoe I used sunk. Abseiling, I said, this is fine, it's easy to do this, and I ended up upside down with my legs in the air, hanging and wondering how. It's fine. So whatever it was, I ever did. But it was, I think, part of the fun of it, maybe because they could see that I was totally incapable. They couldn't make it any worse. But we did that, and we did camps. And some were easier than others, I guess. But that was the sort of the big thing about Bath YMCA. I worked a lot there with residents, and I think that's the first time I'd worked with young adults. And there were... In Bath YMCA, it had a contract with the Ministry of Defence. So a whole bunch of Ministry of Defence apprentices lived there for their first year, which was a bit awkward because they were very clever technically, and they would manage to wire sound systems into the tannoy system, into the PA system. They'd do all kinds of things. They were more intelligent and every year a new bunch came, and you had to put up with the same sort of thing. But it was entertaining them and doing. We did quizzes and all kinds of special events, and we tried to bring in a religious program, which hadn't done anything like that in Dartford. I did in Bournemouth, but in Bath there was prayer week and so on, and I ran. A meditation, sort of Christian meditation thing once a week in the chapel, which was a tiny room, which was often used as a store cupboard as well. Sometimes I'd be the only one there, and that was okay. Sometimes a relief. Other times it was a whole bunch of people would come. So we would try to promote it, and it was a definite spiritual feel to how we were going about things. But I think probably... the changes in the YMCA, one of the changes has been a sort of a flow of the Christian element coming and going. In Bath, we built the youth club up, and we built up a very good sort of social thing with the residents. It wasn't like a homelessness hostel, although there were all kinds of people who had lived there most of their lives. And that was a thing about the hostels that I recall. Is then going back to Bournemouth, there was a guy called Ashley and another one called Arthur. They'd gone there as young men, as caretaking or whatever they were, and they were there and they died there. And that's they lived the whole of their lives. Ashley in Bournemouth was, I think, about 80-odd when he died. And he never moved from YMCA. But no one had had the guts to tell him that on Thursdays he didn't have to replace Arthur. And as a sort of that was his day off. Arthur was like 70 something, and Arthur would sweep around the billiard room and so on, but Ashley would come down in his coat, and he would in a special brown coat, and he would do all that. That was the thing with hostels. There were all kinds of older people, people who couldn't live anywhere else, and it was a strange community of people, and there was no mention of move on. And it was if you lived in the YMCA and you behaved yourself and you helped out a bit and you paid your rent, they wanted to stay forever, especially if they liked you. It was a bit unfair, I suppose, to say that, but that was how people became institutionalised. In Bath, that changed gradually, and we're talking about the sort of early 80s, and people were coming and going more, and that kind of thing disappeared during the 90s, I suppose, really, when people realised that you're supposed to be using hostels just for something else. Bath seems quite a long time ago now. Well, it was 30-something years ago. I did newsletters, and there was some play schemes, but not things had moved on. In Bath, I began to feel that I was just... I was a 30-year-old youth worker now, and I felt that I didn't want to do this all my life. I was getting a bit fed up with not having any decision-making or staff or any understanding of any budgets or So I was really, although I was a deputy to the general secretary, chief executive, I wasn't really given any responsibility. And the time came, one general secretary retired, and another one came, and he went. And the then chief exec of Cardiff YMCA went for the job in Bath, and I met him while he was being interviewed. He didn't get the job, but he'd met me, and he remembered me later, and asked me to join the team. I still had to be interviewed, but I came to Cardiff because he'd gone to Bath to be interviewed for a job that he wanted and didn't get. And I did need to get out of doing the children thing. I didn't really feel I could go any further with it. I didn't really feel I was very good at it in the end, and I needed to do something different. And so I came to Cardiff in 1986, and I was put in charge of the hostel. There was only one hostel. It was half empty, and there were issues. Microphone is back on the table.
Yeah, sorry, I've been part of the table. We're going to continue.
So I came in 1986, towards the end of the year, and I was given the choice of titles. I became the residential housing manager. I was thinking, RHM. And the other person, the youth worker here, was given a choice, and she became the community liaison officer. So we had RHM and CLO. I wasn't residential. I lived next door to the YMCA for a few months. So I lived in what's now known Arthur Hanson. Arthur Sampson House. Two East Grove. So I lived there for a while. And then my family moved up to Cardiff. And my job was first and foremost to make the hostel pay. It was a drag on the whole of the YMCA. My predecessor hadn't been too keen on certain things. And it was very reliant upon a local private school, New College, and passing trade, and backpackers. And a whole group of people who'd lived here forever, as I described earlier. There was always, in a hostel, a core group of people who were quite happy to live in the hostel. There was one person who had been living here since it opened. In fact, there were several people, come think of it, living here. When I got here, who had been here since 1981 or 82. And so it was only 4 years, and one only left about 2 years ago, so and he's living in a flat down the road. But there were some others who have stayed the length of time. But my job was to do that, and I was given a budget. I was told how to write a budget. I was told what a budget was, how to spell budget. It was just so dynamic for me. I had huge enthusiasm, so I threw myself at this job. And I didn't do 24 hours a day, but I may as well have. I wanted to show me and the world that I could do this, and I did. I think it's sort of looking back, maybe I should have spent a bit more time with my family during that period. But I wanted to establish myself, and I wanted it to be a success. And so The school was the first thing to go, because New College was the principal who owned New College. He would walk into the hostel and show parents, "This is my hostel," and show them around. And that wasn't really what I wanted. During those sort of 1986, 7, 8, round about that time, we were a backpackers hostel. I found that you could get three beds sometimes in a room, so single bedrooms, but you know, there were one or two bunks around, so and people would were traveling, they didn't really mind if it would, you know, charging them a fiver. So the place, I was taught about occupancy, how you needed to be putting people in rooms because I'd never thought about occupancy before. So the target was something like 1.90% occupancy, and I'm the only person probably to have achieved something like 120% occupancy by overfilling rooms consistently throughout summer. And so it was it meant that everyone working here, and there were not that many people working here at the time, we all had to keep changing beds every morning and cleaning rooms, because there would be any number of beds during the summer as people came through Cardiff. Cardiff wasn't the tourist attraction it is now, but it certainly was a place where people came. So we were a kind of youth hotel that it had set out to be. The by the end of the 80s, the Tai Cymru Housing for Wales, which was a Quango organisation who oversaw the work of housing associations, started to bring in new rules and said, well, we gave you all this money to build a hostel and you're putting up travellers and backpackers and really you're not unschooled students and so on. Really you should be doing something so that the public money could be used. And homelessness, which hitherto had not been mentioned, in fact, hostels were arguing amongst themselves about each other, stealing each other's clients. That became the thing. I don't know the exact pinpoint the year, but it was the late 80s, early 90s that really homelessness started to be something. And because I'd gone to a meeting, we decided we would take, shock horror, unmarried mothers. And single mums, single dads for that matter, and we converted some rooms on the ground floor of the main hostel, and we converted Arthur Sansom House into family accommodation so that pregnant women could live here, and people with babies and children, and that's started a whole thing off. I ended up in an argument with a mother and baby home that I was taking their clients. That was the sort of thing. And of course, little did we know that the whole thing would get worse and worse and worse. When I was doing that piece of work then, I didn't think that 30 years later we'd still need homelessness hostels. I would have thought that would have been the last thing we would have needed. We would have cured that, and these archaic places, which are still so much in demand, would never exist. But they do. So the change round was quite a culture shock for quite a lot of people, as homeless people were our new clientele. The residents were residents because they didn't have anywhere else to go. And this was, a learning experience for everybody. We were suddenly having to deal with sectioning people and dealing with probation service and social services. And we were seconded a social worker. This was our support work department, was a social worker seconded by social services full-time for a period of 2 years, and then they would change. And that was, I worked alongside, I was the hostel manager then. I dropped the big title and became hostel manager and interviewed everybody that came here. I was given an assistant. So I had a deputy hostel manager, and we had an apprentice one as well. So the management team was about three or four strong. Support team was one. And somehow, this would be outrageous again now. We had no security, really. And the night stewards were old guys who, had retired. So they would sit on reception, and all hell would be let loose, and no one would know about it because it was no CCTV. But it was a strange time, and again, you learn. And I think that sort of to take that out of context would be, everything's about context. We started putting security doors on because it was so that people couldn't just burst into the hostel. We put some cameras up, and these were like early days. Our very first camera actually got stolen. So that was effective, wasn't it? But we started doing things differently. Health and safety things, equal opportunities were things which came in the 90s. And it's hard to think back, though. We never measured ethnicity or gender things. We did have records, but they weren't really a big thing. And we're so much better for it, of course. And people would not do what we were doing in the 90s for all kinds of reasons, sort of for the risk of being killed in the corridor. So we built up a professionalism, we built up our relationships. So Cardiff, for me, there was no more roller skating. That would have been quite fun, I suppose, but roller skating chief executive. But it was about getting more and more professional all the time. And when grants became available to employ support workers, we started a support work team. And I think there were five, and I can't really remember the name of the grant, something like supported housing grant or something like that. And it changed over the years, and different names. And Karina Churchlow was the first employed social worker who became my deputy later on. And we had a team in an office, and we set about doing very much what continued then from the early 90s onwards, in that we had a housing team and a support team. Occasionally we talked about merging the two, and I expect there's still talk about merging the two, but we said we would keep the two separate, and when other people were merging and merging in other hostels. We worked with the other hostels. They started seeing that we weren't, I think they still see us as, in Cardiff YMCA as the posh hostel. I don't know how but it is seen as that, and always was. Our first conversations with Tresillian House were by accident, because we were Tresillian House, the Huggard, and Salvation Army and ourselves were at a meeting, and the person running the meeting hadn't turned up, and the speaker hadn't turned up, and other people left, and the four of us were just left there saying, well, we better have a conversation then, hadn't we? No one really talked to each other, and we set up a group, which the Direct Access Providers Group, I think it was called, DAP. We were given that name by somebody. We had different names, but we started meeting, and the hostel started working together, and that I assume still goes on, in that we invented electronic systems to communicate. We started doing exchange programs, and this was only time goes by, I have no idea, somewhere in the late 90s, and we all started to go to each other's hostels and have a look and understand what we were trying to achieve. It's very difficult because there are all these charities all working for limited resources. So the Cardiff experience for me was, I was the person in charge of the housing association. The chief executive then made me deputy chief executive, another title which I was very proud of, and it didn't mean anything because I just did the same job as I was doing, but it did mean that I was fairly able to get on and do. If he disagreed with me, he'd say, and we'd have an argument, but generally speaking, it kind of worked until it stopped working. And he went off to run the funeral business that he'd set up, and the YMCA funeral business, Green Willow, and that left me as the new, they didn't want to call me chief executive, I was called the general manager, which, okay, I really didn't care by then, I suppose, sort of, you've been in the YMCA 30 odd years, titles were beginning to get a bit tired. So, and another person became the general manager of the YMCA community part, and we worked together quite well for quite a while. And at some point, someone decided that it was a good idea to rename my job chief executive. It was April the 1st of that year, and I wondered whether it was a joke, but it wasn't. And so I eventually got to where I wanted to be, I suppose. But I was still doing the same job. When the previous chief exec left, it did allow me and Karina to establish an entirely different culture in this YMCA, one that we dreamt about for quite a long time. And we had a vision of it being more inclusive and understanding what staff wanted. And we'd already set about investors in people, which was our agenda for running the organisation. And I think we'd achieved it, although I think the investors in people must have felt sorry for us. We achieved it in 2000, I think, first time. And but it was a sort of bare minimum, really. And but we wanted to get gold, and eventually we got gold. And I think we've kept it since. And it meant that you had to have an open consultative organisation where people were, everyone had a view and everyone could be heard and not be bullied and not be ignored. So that everyone had some say. And we brought in health programmes and made it a place where people wanted to work. At least that was, you know, as much as anyone wants to work anywhere. And the first step was to get pay systems in, because the previous system had been fairly haphazard. We brought in pay scales, we brought in holidays, the same holidays for everybody, and pension schemes and so on. So my experience of the last 10 years or so, probably longer, was how to make an organisation the very best you possibly could. And in that time, I think I probably stretched myself to as far as I could possibly go. Big testing times were when the grant got cut, and initially it was entirely cut. We were going to lose the whole of our supported people grant, and it was a wake-up call for the organisation. I guess this must be about 6 or 7 years ago. And I was called to an office down in County Hall Monday morning, 9 o'clock, pretty ominous. Went down there, wondered how many other people were there. There was one other person who ran Oak House. And we didn't know why we were there, but it just didn't feel right. We were called in, the head of housing, and the head of the head of housing, and the head of the head of the head of housing were all there. And they gave us a piece of paper to read, and both organisations, it said, right, your grant's been cut completely. And I don't think I've ever really experienced anything. It's almost like being told someone who's close to you had died, because that meant we had 74 staff at the time. Goodness knows what it meant for the organisation. And I said, is this a done deal? They said, yes, it's a done deal. So it was hard to argue at that point. It was 9 o'clock on a Monday morning. I came back, I couldn't tell anyone. And so we did, however, I did tell someone. And we sat down and said, well, how are we going to do this? How are we going to manage this? It wasn't going to hit us until maybe a few months ahead. And I can't remember what time of year it was. But my job was to, first of all, fight this, because it was the most outrageous thing. Why us? We were the biggest hostel, and still are the biggest hostel in Wales. We were doing the job, and obviously we've been picked on. So I went to every public meeting I could saying we've been picked on, and the council have ratted on us, and this is unfair. In a way that when I look back, that wasn't how I can't see how I did it. But I was so outraged that they called us to a meeting, and they said, you realise this was never a done deal. And I didn't argue with them then, because they were saying, well, what can we do then? And it turns out that what they didn't want to do was fund our hostel in Oakfield Street, the Ambassador. And because they'd found somewhere else for the people that were in the Ambassador hostel. The homeless people there didn't need to be funded anymore, because there was this new place. And it turned out the new place was the Walk. They just moved 27 more places or 30 places into our main hostel. This is obviously, they'd said something and they'd had to backtrack and so on. I wasn't going to hold this over them. Obviously, I still do, because I'm saying about it. But it was the biggest, I think, thing that I've ever had to face in my life. other than maybe close people dying on you. But this was the thing I'd built, the thing that I was part of, the thing I lived, was being attacked by a virus almost. So we fought it, and I think there's only ever been two meetings in the theatre where everyone's been called to the theatre, where every member of staff, three line whip, was put on. And we stage managed the meeting. Neither of you were there, so you. But others in this who are still working here would remember it. So that everyone was sat down, including my media team who already knew. And I was at the bottom of the stage, and I explained that what had happened. And it was a very emotional. I feel myself emotional now, because it was an incredibly emotional moment, because everyone in there, and some people had just started as support workers or whatever, jobs were on the line. There were 70-odd people, and jobs were on the line. So we said, well, I'll say this, what's going to happen, and what's been said. And then I said, right, you can all go out, go and have, talk to your mates, have a cigarette, do whatever you do, then come back in 10 minutes and we'll talk about it some more. And so we went out, and everyone came back, surprisingly. And it was a tough half hour or so of questioning then. And I stood firm that my allegiance, I would not leave, I would fight to the death. I didn't quite say death, but I probably would have. And we came out of that, I think, a far stronger organisation. So although it was the worst moment, I think, that ever, but it was the most dramatic thing. I think I don't know, maybe I was here just for that. If I have faith, and I believe we are all, for some reason, doing whatever it is, and maybe that was my moment. That was that half hour was what I was here for. And people, went away, and strangely, some of the people who left within months of that were all the people who, if I'd have been given a list, who do I want to leave? Maybe I should sign this declaration differently. They all left without very much trouble. And the people who were, the true colours showed, I think, and that may have been just coincidence, but we had to. It did mean that we didn't have to sack too many people. So we lost. Oh, I can't remember the amount even now, but it was £400,000 a year or something like that. It was a huge amount of money. Because we ended up with around about £750,000 a year, which I think is still about the same amount. And then we'd lost about half as much and a bit more again. So we had to set about cuts. We asked all the staff for ideas, and we came, and everybody gave ideas. And I think somewhere in what was my office, there's a list still of all the things which could be done to save money and so on. And people who were amongst those. Some departments said that other departments should be closed immediately. Not theirs. Other places, they're sort of like buildings and projects should go. But generally, there was an air of excitement and enthusiasm, so we turned a very, very bad thing into something which changed the organisation. And I think was, once having got through that, we went on then to do things like the investors in people. I think a lot of the fitness things and other awards that we were going for, we were leaner and fresher and stronger, and we were able to do these things and felt more confident. And I say we, it wasn't just me. This was a group. There was such a team feeling that it was special. I think around about that time, my deputy Karina said it's time for her to go. And I was amazed, because I thought I was going to live forever, and she was going to live, and we were going to do this forever. And it suddenly dawned on me that your time comes to an end in doing different things. So there was, having gained the grant, kept the grant. We tried different things. I think probably that was my greatest moment. I think probably not succeeding with retail was the thing I regret. We set up shops, and we just didn't do it very well. And they're still running, but with another part of the YMCA running them. But we, for a while, that worked too. And I think there were so many different things that have happened. But that grant thing was the big thing. The last few years were a dream. I loved being the chief executive of this organisation. It was just a dream job. And knew I had to go, but I think it was, in my feeling of how I see my life, it was this innocent and stupid young man who was given a youth club to run in Bournemouth. And it took me maybe 43 years to grow up. But in the end, I think I was quite good. And I loved the job and loved doing what I did. I could come in, and it was all about what was in my brain. And I think when you get to the stage where you don't have to clean the toilets anymore, and I was told off some years before for moving furniture around and things, but I was needed to control and to think and to develop. And I was called upon to do that. And it was a stretch at times trying to take on Newport YMCA, which at the moment is in abeyance, and various other projects. But things work in the long term. And you look back, you feel there's a pattern there. I was a young person in the YMCA as a child, and then I was a young person given authority, crazily. And then as I grew older, I was fortunate to be in the right place at the right time and to work with amazing people. And I still think back. I think, well, yeah, someone's going to catch me out one day, that they're going to realise this is only me. So I retired about 14, 15 months ago, and I miss things about work. I don't miss coming to work, but I do miss the YMCA is in my thoughts every day. It's in my prayers every day, and I still think about it. And I think it's a tremendous organisation.
Yeah,
that's a lovely note to end on.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Andrew. I've got all of
them. I could see you getting emotional, yeah. And I thought, it is. Aww. It's a big thing, you know. And I think that, it's been my life, but you know, I've had another life alongside it. I have children and grandchildren, but you know, this, coming back into the building today was quite difficult. I've been for a couple of months, deliberately made the effort not to, to try and move away from it a bit, because I know every nook and cranny. I've shown you the screen here that I know how that aircon works, and I remember when it was put in. I know what was above the ceiling before that was put in, and this was the boxing gym, this room. I had a boxing ring up in here. And all the other stuff, and we'd been an office there, and you know, all the things, I could go around and point out 1,000 different things about this building, because I knew it, how to light the boilers, how to do, and it's it becomes part of you. It's very strange, you know, I think, right? But you have to then, it's like having a child, and your child grows up, and you want to see it every so often. But it's a building. It's only bricks. But I think that current chief exec is brilliant, and he's exactly the right person to take it forward. And are we still recording?
Oh yeah.
He isn't really. There are great plans that, you know, I think, right, we're biblically, you can take people to the mountain, but you're not going to see what's beyond it, and so on. And there are things which I always felt that we should have all the accommodation on this site. I couldn't work out how to do it and not have the ambassador hostel. But there's ways of doing it. But I was never going to be the one that could do that. And because of baggage that we've all got here and relationships over the years, which I've not alluded to, because there have been some strange things. You know, of course, politics always comes into it. But there are great things that can happen. And I think the Newport will be reborn in the future. And we had to save that YMCA in some way or another. It was in the ditch, broke and broken. And we had to do something, but it came almost too late, really. That will happen. Seeing how YMCA Plaza across the way is excelling itself, you know. There's so much that can happen, and it will.
Well, thank you. So we're going to end this here. Thank you, Andrew. That was Andrew Jenkins, our previous chief executive of Cardiff YMCA Housing Association, and Lauren Harris and Keris Terry.